hey, it's Memorial Day weekend, you guys. And that's a cool thing, right? I mean, because we always think in terms of our barbecues and our times at the beach and everything like that. But I just would be remiss not to remind us that for many Americans this week, actually many people around the world, this is a reminder of the price that's been paid by a loved one or a friend in the many, many conflicts that we've had as a nation. And, you know, it's not that we don't want to celebrate. It's not that we don't want to have the barbecues. That's part of the reason that defense of the nation is important, so that we can have the freedom and the space to do these kinds of things. But we also want to remember at what cost that it came to us at. And so this morning, before we begin our teaching, before we go off and have our party, our surf and grill party, I think it would be appropriate for us to have a moment of silence in remembrance of those who've been lost in war. And in that moment of silence, I'm just going to encourage each one of us to, in our own way, in our own words, ask God to bring about an end to conflicts, to replace the madness of war with the wisdom of God. So let's just do that now. Let's just take a moment in reverence for those lost. Then he will judge disputes between nations and settle arguments between many people. They will hammer their swords into plow blades and their spears into pruning shears. Nations will never fight against each other, and they will never train for war again. Isaiah 2:4. And that is our hope when the kingdom of God replaces all of this. So this morning, we're going to continue studying in the Gospel of Matthew, and if you have a way of following along, if you will head over to Matthew chapter 23, please. We're going to cover a lot of ground this morning. There's 39 verses in the chapter, but before you panic or anything like that, there's only a few themes that Jesus repeats through this whole section here, and I decided we're just going to deal with it in one fell swoop. We're reading about the events and the confrontations that take place in the narrative of Jesus as this is like during the final week before Jesus goes to the cross. And we've seen already how he's come into Jerusalem, but he hasn't been doing what everybody expected Messiah to do. He hasn't been kicking out the Romans. Jesus has actually been bringing judgment to the house of God. He cleared the temple. He cursed the fig tree as a sign of what was going to be happening with the temple, and he's been in this series of conflicts with the temple leadership because for some reason they just have not appreciated what he's been saying and doing. But last week we finished up the final debate that Jesus had with the religious leaders, and in chapter 23, Jesus is going to pronounce, it's a famous chapter, he's going to pronounce his woes on the scribes and the Pharisees. Not like, whoa, dude, but like, woe unto you because you jacked up. I titled this teaching. It's different from what if you read the Wonder What blog. I titled this teaching "What the H is Going On" because I've broken Jesus's rebuke down into a series of H words like humility and honesty. And you'll see as we go. But we're going to look at these H words that seem to characterize both the things that we want to avoid and the things that we want to embrace. Jesus is rebuking a specific group of people, the elite religious leadership of the Jewish temple worship system, but his rebuke carries serious reasons for self-examination for us as 21st century American Christians. Matthew wants us to look deeper because all of us who are making up the church, all of us who are the church are representatives of God in this world. And so all of us have the same potential of falling into the snares that these religious leaders fell into as they improperly represented God in this world. This is a rebuke of mishandled leadership, but it can also represent the culture of any given church. So it becomes a challenge for all of us as we read this. So we're going to tackle this a little bit differently today. Normally I like to kind of work our way through a passage, read us a chunk of it, and then kind of expound on it. Today we're going to read through the whole section, and then I'm going to poke back through the text to highlight the specifics of how it is his rebuke could apply to us, what it is that we have to be cautious of and careful of, and also what it is we want to encourage in our church culture. The other thing I want to mention is that for this text, I'm going to be reading out of the NLT, the New Living Translation. I've been reading about this and studying this for a while, and I'm going to start transitioning to this more and more over time, especially with this passage. The ESV is really clunky here, so we're going to be putting it up on the screen, and if you want to follow along and compare the translations, that might even be a good idea, a good exercise for you. But if you're there in Matthew 23, we're going to begin and read all the way through, starting with verse 1. It says, "Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, 'The teachers of religious law and the Pharisees are the official interpreters of the law of Moses. So practice and obey whatever they tell you, but don't follow their example, for they don't practice what they teach. They crush people with unbearable religious demands and never lift a finger to ease the burden. Everything they do is for show. On their arms, they wear extra wide prayer boxes with scripture verses inside, the phylacteries, and they wear robes with extra long tassels. And they love to sit at the head of table, at the table of banquets and in the seats of honor in the synagogues. They love to receive respectful greetings as they walk in the marketplaces and to be called rabbi. Don't let anyone call you rabbi, for you only have one teacher, and all of you are equal as brothers and sisters. And don't address anyone here on earth as father, for only God in heaven is your spiritual father. And don't let anyone call you teacher, for you only have one teacher, the Messiah. The greatest among you must be a servant. But those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. What sorrow awaits you teachers of religious law and you Pharisees, hypocrites! For you shut the door of the kingdom of heaven in people's faces. You won't go in yourselves, and you don't let others enter either. What sorrow awaits you teachers of religious law and you Pharisees, hypocrites! For you cross land and sea to make one convert, and then you turn that person into twice the child of hell you yourselves are. Blind guides, what sorrow awaits you, for you say that it means nothing to swear by God's temple, but that it's binding to swear by the gold in the temple. Blind fools, which is more important, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred? And you say that to swear by the altar is not binding, but to swear by the gifts on the altar is binding. How blind, which is more important, the gift on the altar or the altar that makes the gift sacred? When you swear by the altar, you're swearing by it and everything on it. When you swear by the temple, you're swearing by it and by God who lives in it. And when you swear by heaven, you're swearing by the throne of God and by God who sits on the throne. What sorrow awaits you teachers of religious law and you Pharisees, hypocrites, for you're careful to tithe even the tiniest income from your herb gardens, but you ignore the more important aspects of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. You should tithe, yes, but not to the neglect of the more important things. Blind guide, you strain your water so you won't accidentally swallow a gnat, but you swallow a camel. What sorrow awaits you teachers of religious law, you Pharisees, hypocrites, for you're so careful to clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside you're filthy, full of greed and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisees, first wash the inside of the cup and dish, and then the outside will become clean too. What sorrow awaits you teachers of religious law, you Pharisees, hypocrites, for you're like whitewashed tombs, beautiful on the outside, but filled on the inside with dead people's bones and all sorts of impurity. Outwardly, you look like righteous people, but inwardly, your hearts are filled with hypocrisy and lawlessness. What sorrow awaits you teachers of religious law and you Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build tombs for the prophets your ancestors killed, and you decorate the monuments of the godly people your ancestors destroyed. Then you say, if we'd lived in the days of our ancestors, we would never have joined them in killing the prophets. But in saying that, you testify against yourselves that you are indeed the descendants of those who murdered the prophets. Go ahead and finish what your ancestors started. Snakes, sons of vipers, how will you escape the judgment of hell? Therefore, I'm sending you prophets and wise men and teachers of religious law, but you'll kill some by crucifixion. You'll flog others with whips in your synagogues, chasing them from city to city. As a result, you'll be held responsible for the murder of all godly people of all time, from the murder of righteous Abel to the murder of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you killed in the temple between the sanctuary and the altar. I tell you the truth, this judgment will fall on this very generation. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones God's messengers. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen protects her chicks beneath her wings, but you wouldn't let me. And now, look, your house is abandoned and desolate. For I tell you this, you'll never see me again until you say, blessings on the one who comes in the name of the Lord. All right. Really doesn't even need commentary, I suppose. No, there's a lot there, and there are several specifics of this rebuke that are highlighting idiosyncratic issues that we're not going to be that familiar with. Things that were, you know, pertaining to that particular culture and time, like swearing to the temple or swearing by the temple and the altar and those kinds of things. The final part of this whole section ends up with him kind of forecasting some of the things that are going to be happening as they resist, as they try to persecute the burgeoning church. And then he kind of describes the events that occurred in 70 AD when Rome came in under General Titus, destroyed Jerusalem and destroyed the temple. He's going to go into more detail about that in chapter 24, so we're not going to actually kind of deal with that in this teaching today. We'll wait until we get over there to chapter 24 for that. What I want to look at today are the characteristics of the religious leaders that Jesus critiques. Jesus is highlighting where God's representatives veered off the course that God had set for them, and it becomes a warning for us as the church about what characteristics to embrace and what ones to avoid. But it is a critique of leadership, and we want to keep that in mind. We don't want to diminish that. And here's the thing. This is the church's responsibility. It's the responsibility of the church to hold leadership accountable to what it is that Jesus says in his word here. That means me. That means any of the leaders here within this community. And it's something to keep in mind if your path is leading you somewhere where you're no longer in this fellowship, but you're in a different fellowship somewhere else. When evaluating leadership, when evaluating a church culture, these are the characteristics to keep in mind. Because I've said many times in the past, you've heard me say it, that church is a dangerous place. We become very vulnerable here. It's a place where we put so much trust and hope in the community itself, in the culture, and the leadership of the community. And you know, because there are faulty humans involved in this whole thing, I've said many times, church would be a whole lot easier if it didn't involve people. But because there's faulty human beings in this, there's going to be hurt, there's going to be problems, are going to be issues, and that's why accountability is such an important thing. It takes a community to stand course. It requires community participation, observance, action. One of the reasons why we've got bad leadership in the church at times is because the church is allowing for bad leadership to be there. It takes a church community to remain accountable to these things. So those are things to keep in mind. So let's look at what Jesus critiqued in the leadership of his day, and let's see how it is that we can remain accountable to each other staying on the course, right? Does that sound like a plan? So the first, we're going to break this down, as I said, into a series of H words. The first H word that we want to consider is one that's almost an overarching theme of this whole rebuke, and that is honesty. A rhetoric must match reality. Our words need to match what's really going on. Jesus was, without fail, always compassionate when he was dealing with everyday sinners, you know, the people that were openly living in with disregard to what it is God's purposes were. You know, he's dealing with prostitutes, he's dealing with extortioners, he's dealing with Sabbath breakers. Without fail, he's compassionate, he's kind, he's caring and all that. But when it comes to hypocrisy, I mean, Jesus sort of turns into Gordon Ramsay here, and he's just up in their face and he's shouting. Jesus, in all of the Gospels, Jesus reserves nothing but scorn for those who participate in play-acting at religion. And he gives examples. They wear the phylacteries. That was, you know, in the Old Testament law. God said to bind his words to their hands and to their forehead. They misinterpreted that and made actual literal physical boxes that they put scriptures in and tied to them. So he said they made sure they wore really big ones and the tassels on the prayer shawls. He made sure they had like whisk brooms on there, just big old things to show how pious they were. But both of those things were supposed to be representative symbolic of a person's submission to the authority of God. And he's saying you put on this big show, but you're not really living your lives under God's authority. You've created your own authority structure. They cleaned, he said, the outside of the bowl, but left the inside corrupt. And the whole thing is they did their religious stuff for show, to be seen, so that they looked right and good, but it didn't have any bearing on the heart. It didn't have any bearing on what was going on in the reality of their personality or how it is that they were living. Now, the thing about something like this, we make a charge about hypocrisy and stuff and honesty. If we're going to be real, if we're going to be honest about this with ourselves in all of this, everybody is guilty on some level of being hypocritical. I mean, you know, of wanting to protect our image. Who here doesn't, to some degree, try to maneuver to protect their own image? You know, projecting what only looks good for the approval of others. You know, social media, that's the drug of choice when it comes to that sort of behavior, only making sure that we're representing, you know, what we are like or who we are. And to varying degrees, all of us struggle and stumble with this issue of honesty and not wanting to really reveal who we are. When people say to me, you know, I don't go to church, it's full of hypocrites, I usually say, no, it's not. There's plenty of room for one more. Come on in. But now, we say that kind of stuff, and that's not to say to try to excuse hypocrisy. We should be yielding to the work of the Holy Spirit to reshape that impulse in our lives. But what Jesus is getting at is a systematic hypocrisy. He's talking about an institutionalized, intentional approach to spirituality that focuses on externals to the neglect of the heart, to the neglect of real change that needs to be taking place. So as the church, what the challenge is for us is we need to develop a culture of honesty, where honesty about our struggles, honesty about our failures, honesty about our doubts are not condemned, but lovingly acknowledged, recognized, and we're given space to work through those things. We've given the space necessary to allow the Holy Spirit to do that reshaping of our lives. We need to have a culture where we can be real with God and real with each other, where we're not afraid of being condemned or scorned because of our doubts. Because the only way we're ever going to see tangible change taking place in our lives is by honestly confronting those things that are going on in our lives. So we want a culture where we're not afraid that we're going to be judged for being honest. Jesus never seemed to be interested in looking respectable in all of his ministry. That never seemed a priority. He was only interested in getting at the heart of what was going on with each of the individuals he was dealing with. But the Pharisees, the religious leaders, they were concerned about being respectable, and that leads us to the next H word, and that is humility. We must intentionally not seek honor from our fellow human beings. And Jesus gives several examples of that sort of behavior, expecting, you know, the best seat. They always wanted to sit up on the platform somewhere, the revered greetings from the little people in the marketplaces as they went by. And then he talked about taking on titles that elevated them above their fellow persons, titles like rabbi or father or teacher. Now, people will function in those roles in our lives. People, you know, Paul referred to himself as a spiritual father to Timothy, but he didn't take that title on to himself. We can have spiritual fathers or mentors. People will function like that in our lives, in those roles. He wasn't saying that it was wrong to provide instructive ideas through teachings or anything like that. He wasn't saying it was wrong to function like that. He was talking about taking on the title that elevated them above their peers, a title that distinguished them as being elevated in some way. You know, it's this passage right here, guys, is why, you know, this is why I encourage us not to attach a title to my name. I don't want to go by Pastor Rob. And I know that it even kind of becomes a joke around here, you know, kind of like, yeah, Rob doesn't want to be called Pastor Rob. You know, well, then what do we call him? How do I introduce him to people? Yeah, this is Rob. He's our that guy, you know? And so I went round and round with somebody about this just the other day. And I'm not trying to create some new legalism or something like, you know, oh man, we got afraid of saying that word around here. It's not that. But I'm saying that as a church, as a community, it's our responsibility to work actively at developing a culture of equality, one where we recognize the equality and the value of every person in here, not just a few. Listen, the thing about our evangelical churches right now, they are steeped in the celebrity model of a pastor. Matt Redman wrote a book called The God of the Mundane, and these are his words. I can't speak to this, but he says that he only knew two types of pastors, the ones who sit in a green room before they go on stage, and the ones who want to be those who sit in green rooms before they go on stage. And that, you know, but there's this whole celebrity kind of mentality that's crept into the evangelical church. As a community, we've got the responsibility to not do that and to not encourage that sort of inequality, that sort of elevation of a faulty human being. Because when we do that, when that faulty human being fails or hurts us somehow, and because faulty human beings have a genius for doing that, it's going to happen. I know I've hurt people here. I'm so sorry for the times that I have, but it's just going to happen. And if we've elevated that person to some place in our minds that's somehow above the rest of us, that's going to affect our attitude towards God over time. So we've just, you know, we've got to be careful about it. And if we are in leadership, we've got to acknowledge the temptation to be recognized. To, you know, it's the whole thing. It's a cooperative kind of thing. The evangelical culture wants to create a celebrity, and they're kind of cooperate with that. And you like having a celebrity involved in the whole thing, or somebody who's the unique person. And listen, from the leadership side, there's a temptation. There's a temptation there to want to be that kind of person. This has to be acknowledged and resisted. What all of us have to do, and especially those in leadership, is to live unselfconsciously. That is to live a life for God's pleasure and not for human esteem. That's a lifetime worth of learning there. So it's not like we wake up tomorrow and that's been taken care of. But those are the things that we acknowledge, we recognize that are here. Let's acknowledge, we give it name. And we resist it. We resist moving in those directions. And it ties to another H word, this esteeming others, and that is hierarchy. We need to renounce the world's power over people model of leadership. If we start esteeming others as elevated in the community, it gives room for authoritarian practices, which the Pharisees and the scribes had fallen into. Jesus described the religious leaders as crushing people with unbearable religious demands that they insulated themselves from, that they actually didn't have to participate in. They were exercising power over people. And that is something God never intended. And we've got to realize that. Hierarchies don't blend well with the church, with what it is that God's doing. When God got in the business of setting up a government, which he did with Israel in their ancient history, as God establishes them, there's something that he left out of their system that all the other nations around them had. Anybody remember? We've talked about it before. They didn't have a king. God intentionally left that part out because power over people was not his model. He had judges who led from among the people. That's what the idea was in that. So the power over people model is the world's model. That's what God even warned Israel. You want a king, this is what it's going to look like. Because it's ugly. It doesn't work. Lance Ford wrote an outstanding book called Unleader, where he challenges the whole CEO model of leadership that's kind of crept into the church with an authoritarian edge to it. God never intended there to be a hierarchy in the church. I've said that from the day that Eastgate started, and I say it boldly today. We are called to be a community of priests in equality with Christ as our head. That's why Paul adamantly states in Romans 14 that a person will stand or fall before their own master. They'll answer to their own master, and he makes it very clear that master is Jesus. Not another faulty human being, but Jesus is the one that we answer to. Certainly there's going to be leaders. If everybody's in charge, then no one is. Nothing can be accomplished. There will be leaders, people who serve in roles of leadership, but true leadership, true teaching is not done from the top down in some sort of authority structure. Real leadership, real teaching, as God reveals it in the New Testament, is alongside, as a fellow traveler, as a companion, offering a perspective and guidance, never as an authoritarian command of what has to be done. The elevation of leadership over people has created problems all through church history, not the least of which is our next H word, and that is human religion. We must not impose ourselves or our views as the standard that somehow God expects from everyone. Again, this touches those unbearable religious demands that Jesus was referring to them. And the example he gave of crossing land and sea to make a disciple who becomes twice the child of destruction as themselves, making disciples who not who are following God, but disciples who are following them and what it is that they teach and expect. And that's when Jesus went into this example of swearing by the temple. It was something that was done in the religious context of that day, where they devised this loophole for following through with an oath that was being made. So, you know, it's like, yeah, I know I swore that I'd sell you my cow, but I didn't swear on the gold in the temple, so it doesn't really count. So I'm not selling you the cow. It seemed silly to us today, but in that cultural time frame and context, it was just a way of putting a religious spin on being a jerk, you know, just being looking pious as you do it, pointing to something that seemed godly. And it was something that they made up on their own. It wasn't something that God had ever instituted or even encouraged at any point. It was something that they had developed, and then they used that as the standard. And the issue that Jesus is getting at was the substitution of their own views and their example as being the proper or acceptable standard for pleasing God. And that's wrong. As leaders and as the church, we've got to be careful that we don't look at our take on God's purposes, look at our understanding of how it is that we're going to follow God and see that as the right way in contrast to everybody else who's wrong. We're called to lead people to be followers of Jesus, not us. And if we start codifying our approach, how it is that we go about doing community together, how it is that we form all these kinds of things, if we start codifying our approach to following Jesus and desiring to impose that on other believers, then we're going to be guilty of advancing a human religion. We're going to be guilty of the same things that they were involved in. And doing that is going to veer our focus away from Christ and onto the details of these things, you know, the particulars of how we believe we're supposed to follow Jesus. For instance, we have to use this community as an example because this is where we're doing community. So for instance, you know, we've got a casual approach to how it is that we meet or how it is that we do communion or a lack of a formal membership. We could look at those types of things and start using that as a measurement for right or wrong. And so if we're somewhere else, we're with fellowshipping with another community and they're doing communion completely differently, you know, if we start going, we do it so much better, it's so much more right when we're doing it, then we're off on a tangent of advancing human religion. Focusing on those details can be problematic because it can tempt us to leave other more important things unattended, which leads us to the next H word that seems to be present in what it was that Jesus was saying, and that is a humane spirituality, where our walk of faith is extended as a loving care for people, for other people. Jesus used the example of how the Pharisees tithed even in minutia, you know, the stuff that other people would think, I'm not going to get into the herb garden and find all the tenth of all of these things, thinking that those little details of faithful observance to the letter of the law were the things that pleased God. Well, that's what God's looking for. He needed that little bit of mint because he's making tea or something. But Jesus is making it clear that if our desire to be faithful to God doesn't extend outward in kindness and justice and mercy towards our fellow human being, then we've missed the whole point of what it means to be faithful to God. That our religious observance is not faithfulness to God if it's not expressed in a love for people. We kind of talked about this last week, but he illustrated it with hyperbole. He talked about straining out a gnat of the drinking water. It was a practice that they would do before they would drink from a cup. They would strain out anything that might be there, because if you have a gnat in there and the gnat's dead, then it makes the water impure. It's ceremonially unclean because it's touched something dead, and then it's going to touch your lips, and then you're ceremonially unclean. And so they're going to strain a gnat. But then he, you know, devises this humorous picture. You know, he'd do all this work to strain out this gnat and then turn around and swallow a camel whole. And it wasn't so much the size, but it was a notoriously unclean animal for the Jewish people. So he's saying, we would say something like along the lines of, you missed the forest for the trees in this. And these, I believe, honestly, I believe these are huge blind spots for our present evangelical church, where people will consider it pious faithfulness to exclude and condemn other people, including their fellow Christians, on the basis of their interpretation of some isolated passage in Scripture. And it ends up missing the larger sweep of what God challenges us as the human race to do, to love and forgive and demonstrate grace for all people. If our obsession over the interpretation of a passage is expressed through condemning or marginalizing or oppressing our fellow human being, something is amiss. We got to stop at that point and challenge that. What are we doing? Why are we doing this? Jesus makes it clear. That's missing the point. That's swallowing a camel. Our faithfulness is meant to result in a humane spirituality. In fact, with Jesus as our example, as we look at what characterized his ministry, if we're truly going to follow him, then there's one last H word we need to consider, and that is healing. We need to look at his example in contrast to the religious leaders and realize that we need to be inclusive of all people to be reconciled with God. Jesus condemned the Pharisees, he said, because they shut the door of the kingdom of heaven in people's faces. They wouldn't go in themselves, and they wouldn't let others enter either. They wouldn't let anyone in. Their obsession with purity laws ended up focusing then on who was excluded. That became their primary focus, and acting like guards, like bouncers at a club. They were going to stand there and determine who was worthy of getting, you know, scrutinize everybody to see if they're worthy of approaching God. And in contrast to that, as we've been going through the entire Gospel of Matthew for a year now, we've seen in every case, Jesus does the opposite. He keeps flinging the doors wide open, going to the people that everybody was excluding and inviting them in. Anyone who's thirsty, come to these waters and drink. Jesus was indiscriminate with his interest in healing people. So much of it was, you know, that of his work, of his healing work that's revealed in the Gospels was intended to characterize the work of God's kingdom, what it is that God is about, what it is that it means for his will to be done on earth like it's done in heaven. God's big plan is to heal humans who are broken and sick from sin, from everything that's gone wrong in the fall. Our calling, according to Paul in 2 Corinthians 5, is a ministry of reconciliation, calling out to all people in all nations to come and be reunited with the God who created us. Come back home. We were never called to be the moral police. As the church, we were never called. We were never given a ministry of being the moral police in any given culture. We will represent a healed morality in the way that we live our lives and conduct ourselves in the larger community. We were never called to straighten people out before we bring them to God, though our lives will be an example of what God's healing love can do, how he does transform and change and heal. We were never called to determine who's in or who's out with God. That was never our responsibility. That's not our prerogative. We don't have the skill set for that. But we were called to be witnesses who point to the reality of God's grace extended to a sinner, even like me, who was allowed to come in. This chapter, it's an important reminder for us as the church and for leaders in the church. Let's see to it that our values and our priorities are set on the issues that Jesus has called us to. Let's see to it that we're not allowing even the shifts and the changes in culture to veer us from the course that Jesus set us on. Even in these words that he spoke to the Pharisees, let's see that our hearts are honest, that we're humble before him and before each other, that we're humane in kindness towards our fellow human being and healing. Let's see to it that our faithfulness to God is expressed in extending God's healing love to the world around us. If we were to set out and determine to show God's love to the world first and foremost, I honestly believe that in itself would begin to reshape and change the world around us if we do that. So let's take his rebuke, let's take the challenges of it, and let's commit our hearts to embracing this challenging call that he gives us as a church, as leaders. Right on? All right, very cool. Why don't you stand up with me, please?